Andrew Sullivan has a terrific new piece. It is called The Poison We Pick, and it's about opioid addiction and the difficulties we face. The President of the United States today spoke to an opioid summit that the White House has rightly and appropriately convened. Andrew, thanks very much for joining us on what I know must be a very, very busy day for you.
No, it's always a pleasure, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you. The sheer scale of the suffering that you write about in your piece, which actually gives some perspective on the history of this entire addiction, this entire American curse. One paragraph leaped out at me. You write, "When we see the addicted stumbling around like drunk ghosts or collapsed on sidewalks or in restrooms, their faces pale, their skin riddled with infection, their eyes dead to the world, we often see only misery. What we do not see is what they see. In those moments, they feel beyond gravity, entranced away from pain and sadness." The very essence of the appeal of opioids, of oxycodone, and so many of the others, is what exactly, Andrew Sullivan?
It's an escape from pain. I mean, that's what this drug, at its essence, really is. It's a pain killer. And that makes it different than other drugs, which might make you energetic or aggressive or positive. This is a drug people take because they're miserable and they want somehow not to tackle that or to engage life more fully or to do something that might actually provoke and promote their activity. But they do it to drop out, to disappear, to give up, to surrender. And they do it partly because the experience of opium or opioids in various degrees has always been, I mean, since the beginning of human civilization, an incredibly attractive, seductive form of intense pleasure. You can see Homer marveling at it. You see it in ancient Greece. You see it in Egypt. You see it in Neolithic remains 6,000 years ago. This substance, which comes out of a little poppy flower, has proliferated everywhere, and it's always had attraction for human beings. And yet, at the same time, from the very beginning, from the ancient Greeks themselves, they understood that this was also terribly dangerous. That the pleasure it gives you makes you indifferent to life and death, even. That it's one of the most potent substances humans have ever come across, the most tempting. And at this point in human history, our minds, our brains have been able to finesse it, to process it, to actually create more and more intense and concentrated forms of it, that at this point are killing tens of thousands of people, young, middle-aged, old, from different racial backgrounds, but primarily right now in the heartland of this country, the very heart of it. And I think those of us who live on the coasts or live among cultural elites or multicultural big cities care about these people because we don't know many of them. And in the same way that in some ways people ignored AIDS when it started, the deaths from AIDS, because these people were other, these people were not part of our lives, these people were also doing things you disapprove of, like shooting themselves up or having sex with too many people, we just push it out of our minds. But these are our fellow citizens. They're our fellow human beings. What's happening to them is also happening to their families and their communities in a way that is, I think, more devastating than any previous drug epidemic in the history of this country.
I think that's incontestably popular. That's incontestably true, that this is the most serious drug epidemic I think that we have ever had. I want to get to what is to be done in just a moment. 1-800-955-1776, our phone number, by the way. Andrew, you write about this so well. Have you had any experience yourself with opioids?
No. Well, I've occasionally had around the Percocet after a tooth extraction or a broken elbow, But like the vast majority of people that have opioid experiences, I didn't become addicted. It lasted for a short amount of time. It was extremely helpful in my pain.
Right. I asked you because I had when I was recovering from cancer, and I had cancer treatment, throat cancer, stage 3. And I was prescribed fentanyl, which is a very, very dangerous drug, and oxycodone, and which are two of the biggest problems in terms of opioid addiction. And it scared me a lot. I never took my full prescribed dose because I was terrified of getting addicted. And one point that I would take you on is I don't... Uh-huh. I don't think that any Americans are so isolated in some kind of elitist bubble that we don't know. I know people who have battled opioid addiction. There are people in talk radio who have had opioid addiction very publicly. Mm. And I think it's become ubiquitous when you have 66,000 people dying every year, which is more than the total number of murders and suicides and traffic accidents combined, right?
Yeah, it's why this country alone, of all developed countries, is seeing its actual lifespan reduced 3 years in a row for white people in America and 2 years for everybody in America.
So what do we do about it, Andrew?
Well, it's very complicated at this point, and it's rather difficult at this point in the process to try and go back and reverse it. I think you can do some practical things. You can make sure that replacements for heroin and fentanyl are available to people. In other words, you can get them on something like buprenorphine, and methadone, and those methods, and they're not being fully funded enough to get people to ease to simulate what happens with heroin without the severe consequences. You can distribute more naloxone, which is the antidote, so that when people see people collapsing. And by the way, one of the places this is happening is public libraries everywhere, as a story in the New York Times pointed out today. And you could quickly, anybody can quickly put this nasal spray into them and they will revive.
Yeah, it can be a life-saving drug.
Yes.
And you don't get addicted to naloxone, right?
No, that doesn't happen. You don't get addicted as such to methadone or to buprenorphine in the sense that we do with heroin. However, the trouble is that once people have gotten to the point where they're addicted to heroin, especially heroin laced with fentanyl, it's very hard to persuade them to trade that feeling for any other feeling. And it's very hard to reach them. You offer them methadone, they don't really want it. And the places that have actually reduced death significantly, which is in Vancouver in Canada and Portugal in Europe in particular, and Switzerland, have actually opened up safe injection heroin sites so that they allow people to actually continue with their heroin use, but in a way that is controlled and keeps them alive.
Okay, this is a very huge controversy right here in Seattle right now. I'm speaking with Andrew Sullivan, the best-selling author, proud journalist, and author of an important new piece in New York Magazine, The Poison We Pick. Speaking with Andrew Sullivan, his piece, The Poison We Pick, is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. You should read it. It's moving, it's informative, it's insightful, and very, very important about the opioid crisis and the addiction crisis generally in the United States. Andrew, you subtitle the piece, or the subheading they use is, "This Nation Pioneered Modern Life. Now epic numbers of Americans are killing themselves with opioids to escape it." The question I would put to you is why now? And particularly at this given moment in the last year a lot of Americans have seen their viewpoint of the world brighten somewhat as the economy has brightened. There are larger numbers of people who think the nation is actually on the right course. There are reasons to think the unemployment is down. People are saving again. Things seem to be getting better. Why has the opioid crisis not abated at all, but only intensified?
I think because that all may be the case, but the rapid pace of economic and technological change may have generated jobs, but the jobs don't have the same meaning or purpose that they used to have, especially among people without college degrees, who used to have many more choices, better options, better pay, and jobs. For example, think of the local butcher or the local baker or the local. Now everybody just simply works at Walmart. Think of all the small businesses that have disappeared because of Amazon. Think of the way we also communicate with each other increasingly, which is virtually, not physically. So we're more isolated. We see higher numbers and higher numbers of single-person households. We've seen a collapse of the traditional family. And childhood trauma is one of the biggest correlations with adult drug addiction. And I think we've seen a lack and a loss of spirituality and religion that brings people together in community, as opposed to rather abstract, individualized religion. It's not true to say this is due to economics in the sense that you can look, for example, at other Western nations that have had much worse times in the last decade or two than the U.S. They have nothing like the epidemic that we have. Now, part of it is also, I think, social trauma of change. I mean, you look back in history, and the two other big epidemics that we see was, one was in England at the turn of the Industrial Revolution, when people were taken out of their rural homes and put into big cities and big factories without the traditions and habits of life. And that was a huge opium addiction. You see it also in this country, particularly during and after the Civil War. The whole later 19th century, opium was ubiquitous. It was easier to get an opium tincture in 1870 than to get a cigarette in 1970 in this country. So it was also responding to the huge loss of life, the grief, and, of course, the physical pain. I think you have to look at widespread social and cultural trauma, a loss of meaning, a collapse of religion, a collapse of the family, and a collapse of meaningful work that has led people into this wilderness of despair.
So that begs the question, and the president was trying to get at this a little bit earlier today. What would you recommend if President Trump were smart enough to pick up the telephone and say, Andrew Sullivan, you've written about this issue, you've researched it, the history of it, the context for it. Where should I lead the country to help reduce this pain and suffering? What would you tell the president?
Here's what I would tell the president. There's some things you cannot do, actually. But I think the critical things, as I said before, is distributing the right drugs and antidotes that can wean people off this. But I also honestly think that prohibition and the harsh enforcement of these laws against this use has pushed a lot of people into the underground in ways that they need to be brought out of to treat them and to bring them back into the fold of the human family. Telling people their coal jobs are coming back is just a delusion. It's not a reality. Be honest with people.
He's a president today was speaking about reinstituting the death penalty for following the course of the Philippines and dealing with drug dealers and other countries. I take it you think that would be a negative idea.
Well, since most of the drug dealers in this particular crisis were simply family members, then you would be executing a hell of a lot of people. What happened is, I mean, what you can do is cut down somewhat on prescribing these drugs. I mean, it was insane, the volume of drugs that were pummeled and channeled through the system. I mean, 780 million oxycodone pills in West Virginia over 6 years for a population of 1.8 million is simply insane. So that has to be done at the top. the drug companies need to be more careful. On the other hand, if you simply cut off the supply of these pills, people will go without therapy, counseling, and support. People will go to the black market, start doing heroin, and then possibly fentanyl. And fentanyl is crucial here. It's a new thing. It's growing very fast and very quickly, and it's responsible for most of the overdoses.
I've understood this, but it's not people. When I was prescribed fentanyl, it was through a fentanyl patch. You put the patch on your upper arm. But that's not what is causing these overdoses. What's causing the overdoses is they grind it up and smoke it or swallow it. What?
No, they smoke it with it's in the heroin, so it's laced with it. Here's the difficulty. You take the equivalent of 7 grains of salt of this stuff and you ingest it. It will give you the most intense high you've ever had. Take 9 grains and it will kill you. So it's incredibly concentrated and dangerous, impossible to dose correctly on the streets. And that's what's happening. People are dying from that, not knowing that that's in it. It's a sort of poisoning, in a way, of heroin with this super, super heroin. The trouble is you can't really control its arrival into the country because finding the tiny little needle in the haystack of this incredibly microscopic material through 500 million packages coming into the country every year, it comes directly often from China and you can get it on the dark web. So little of it is necessary that it can spread very quickly. And it give you an example of what's happening. In New Jersey, the police report that 3 years ago, 2% of the heroin had fentanyl in it. Now that they seized, had fentanyl in it. Now 30% of it does.
1-800-955-1776, our phone number. Stacy in Phoenix, Arizona. Stacy, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Andrew Sullivan.
Hello, gentlemen. Yes, my name is Stacy, and I have chronic intractable migraine syndrome. I have had a very painful migraine for the last 15 years, every day of my life, and I am currently under very strict doctor's care. I take opioids in order to just maintain, to be able to just function during the day. And I just want to caution you gentlemen that when you speak on a national stage like this and you speak in generalities about people who take these medications, about how they're all addicted or they're all drug users or there's a stigma. And for people like me who literally cannot function without it, I have been on every medication that there is for migraines over the course of these 15 years. I've got a neurostimulator implant. I have been through every procedure that's available. And
thank God. And this is working for you right now, right? I mean, it's actually, God bless you. And by the way, I acknowledge, Stacy, I was taking fentanyl and oxycodone, which was prescribed to me when I was recovering from cancer. So, Andrew Sullivan?
I think Stacy makes a really important point, and I certainly don't want to dismiss it. Many of these drugs have been lifesavers for people who live with chronic pain. They've liberated people. And they're an important part of medicine right now, especially with chronic and acute pain. And I think I certainly don't mean to attach a stigma to this at all. I just think that the majority of people who end up as addicts, 80% of them, did not get these pills through a regular prescription for an actual ailment. They got it from their family members who had these prescriptions and who shared them.
Well, let's
that
go.
That is what happened.
Let's go to Tim in Roswell, Georgia. Tim, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Andrew Sullivan.
Hello, Mr. Sullivan. Hello, Michael. I appreciate this so much. I'm an addiction counselor, and I've got a little bit of history in this. And you say 80% gets 80% of the pills are delivered through their family members. Well, where did the family members get them? My understanding is that 30% of these drugs are prescribed by physicians. And they are given those prescriptions well more than what the state kid wrenches his back in a football game. He's given up well more than he needs for that. And he gets a prescription beyond that. And by the time he's finished with that, he's hooked. And he starts this thing off. My experience has been with just about everybody I've talked to is the reason they stay on them for so long because it's extraordinarily expensive compared to heroin. They don't want to put a needle in. You talk about stigma. That's the stigma. And when they've spent all the money they can steal from their parents and they've sold everything they can possibly steal, and they've turned into these antisocial monsters that their parents look at and go, well, what happened to you?
Andrew.
Yes, I do think the doctors overprescribing, and some of them in the heartland were criminal in terms of the way they operated pill mills and got loads of people addicted. Part of it also happened because there was a demand in the 90s and early 2000s for pain to be removed entirely with these drugs. There was a belief you could use them without getting people addicted. And so too many people were put on these drugs for too long a time. And that's what's happened. As I said earlier, like 780 million pills sent to West Virginia with only 1.8 million.
Where does that number come from? How is 780 million pills? This was sent to West Virginia over what period of time, Andrew Sullivan?
6 years, 2006 to 2012. It's largely because doctors let their patients down. It's largely because the doctors are also under extreme pressure to facilitate treatment more quickly because there were pressures on them to be more efficient. And when someone comes in and say they have a pain, it's often the longest diagnosis you can have. It could be all sorts of things.
All right.
And much quicker to say, okay, take these pills.
Andrew Sullivan, thank you for your contribution and for your enlightenment and your honesty on all of these issues.